following program has been pre-recorded. This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this July 22nd, 2023 program. This show is being taped, and there are going to be a series of shows where you'll have new information and a new introduction, but we're going to go back and use some interviews for the next five shows that have been used in the past and are somewhat popular, things where people inquired and said they would like to know more about it. So we decided to do something of that nature while I will be out of the office and traveling. So we're going to start off with today's interview. We're going to replay the interview that we did with Dr. Kristen Zarfos, where we talked about the new criteria for mammography and the evaluation and treatment of breast cancer, combined with Dr. Lenore Williams, who is an obstetrics and gynecologist, and we talked about maternal death rates. If you'll recall, maternal death rates have been rising in the United States, and especially among Black women. So we chatted with her, and we did that under the realm of the Mother's Day theme. So we've had a lot of questions about that, especially with regard to new developments in regard to maternal health. So I hope you're going to enjoy that interview. But let's start with this day in medicine, July 22nd, 1893. John Ray, who's a physician and an Arctic explorer, passed away. So he was a Scottish surgeon, but a lot of his exploration and adventures were in northern Canada. He was the first physician to go to the Arctic. And it's interesting because I think there's this certain nature in physicians, well, in all humans, but especially in physicians, to go into exploration. Because I think it's one of the reasons why we went into medicine, especially in neurology and neurosurgery, because there's so much being discovered on a daily basis about how the brain works and how it relates to all of our health. So I don't find it odd that a physician like John Ray would become an explorer. One of the things that has come up in the news recently is President Biden using CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure. So CPAP, first of all, you have to understand that 22% of all adults between the ages of 18 and 90 have obstructive sleep apnea, which is the principal cause for the need for CPAP. And the risk of developing obstructive sleep apnea increases with age. Typically, we see it in older individuals, males, and often it's an anatomic problem where the throat is unable to remain open. It's obstructive. And you'll also see it in people who are obese. Now, it doesn't always fit everybody. But the reason why this is important in the President of the United States is because often, people with obstructive sleep apnea who do not use CPAP will develop problems with mentation. They have excessive daytime somnolence, so they're falling asleep at odd times during the day. They have these pauses in breathing, and you'll also hear loud snoring when they sleep. I think it would be more of a story if we found out the president had obstructive sleep apnea and was not using one of these devices. And we've discussed apnea with pulmonologists on our program before, especially because you're seeing a lot of ads for the Inspire, which is where you don't have to wear a mask. And it is something that's implanted, and you use a little device for obstructive sleep apnea. Now, the problem with that is not a typical form of obstructive sleep apnea. The Inspire device only applies to a smaller group of people where the obstruction occurs based on the drive of the breathing system. So that is not for everybody when you see that and you wonder, well, why is somebody still using a mask when they can be using the Inspire device? Well, next up, we're going to get to the interview with Dr. Kristin Sarfos, where we chatted with her and talked about breast cancer and diagnosis of breast cancer. That'll be followed by the interview with Dr. Lenore Williams. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing.
We're back
mama.
On Healthy Rounds. Lay that I'm your host, Dr. Down. Anthony Alessi. If you have questions for us live on the air, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. Happy to take your questions. And our first guest is Dr. Kristin Sarfos. As I mentioned, she's now the former director of the Trinity Health Comprehensive Women's Health Center, but she remains a fierce advocate for women here in the state of Connecticut. And as we speak, she is at the Connecticut Breast Health Initiative run in New Britain. Kristin, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on. It's always great to work with you.
Thank you for taking time from the run today, and hopefully you had a great turnout.
We did. We had, and the weather was with us, and it's about the same issue we want to talk about, empowering women to take care of themselves.
Let's get right to it then. Finally, great. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has shown us some sense in terms of getting on board with an appropriate recommendation regarding mammography. How appropriate is this?
Well, as you and I know, we always look at the glass as full as possible. So I embrace and applaud them for starting mammograms at age 40 rather than 50, which was their previous recommendations in 2016. And it's taken them a while to come up with new recommendations. However, the recommendations are for mammograms every other year rather than every year. And there has been data around for a long, long time from around the world and looking at the United States that mammograms every year are what's key to impacting the death rate from breast cancer. In other words, we've got to find it early. The data since the 90s with mammograms annually showed 40% decrease in mortality rates. So I'm just puzzled why now we would abandon annual mammograms and go to every other year.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, is this, first of all, I always think, and maybe I'm a skeptic here, but I think these guidelines are driven by insurance companies trying to save money. Am I right? I mean, is that why they're going to every other year?
I don't know, and I don't want to be cynical or unfair without having the facts, but all I know, as you and I as providers, this is harmful to women. And we, if you and I and other providers don't say, come on, let's use common sense here. We have data since 1990, as I said, that shows annual mammograms save lives. Why would we abandon it? So I think your job and my job is to heighten awareness to women for them to be empowered and proactive in saying, look, these guidelines are confusing. I want a mammogram every year. And I think it's important because 70% of women with breast cancer have no family history of breast cancer. And I think you've done a great job unveiling that myth that, oh, I'm not going to get breast cancer unless somebody in my family has. So we have to, which was what you do every week, empower women with facts.
Well, I thank you, and we try to do that here. But I'm still concerned. You know, I saw another patient this week for an unrelated problem, but again, in her 30s with metastatic stage 4 breast cancer. I know of at least three people personally under the age of 40 with metastatic breast cancer. So, you know, what are we supposed to do about that in terms of those women?
Well, you know, certainly what you're speaking about, and I don't know the ethnicities of the women that you saw, but 33% of black women develop breast cancer under the age of 50, and they're at a higher risk. And sadly, there's a lack of education, again, which is your mission, to reverse that, among providers, that's doctors, primary care, gynecologists, nurse practitioners, PAs, and among the population. And when the population hears these confusing messages, they just shut down and then abandon everything. So I think we have to educate everybody. We have to also encourage women to know their breasts. And years ago, the concept of self-exam monthly was abandoned based on one study out of China in 2022, even though the authors of that study said women should still do self-exam. But we've abandon encouraging women to know their bodies and take care of them with self-exam, being speaking out to their physicians. And we need to educate people that breast cancer can happen just like with those women you've addressed at a younger age. How frequently I have heard advocates speak, patients come to me, my doctor says I'm too young to have breast cancer. We need to erase that concept, unveil that myth, and educate people to know that it can happen. I've seen women as young as 28, 23 with breast cancer.
So what about the upper limit, age 74? Okay, so that's where the new guidelines are. Is that appropriate?
No, absolutely not. And the data has been very clear for decades. The highest incidence of breast cancer is women in their 70s and 80s. And so you're right. They say stop at 74. But you know what? You and I know there are so many women out there, 70s and 80s and 90s, that are very vital and have full lives. Now, the American Society of Breast Surgeons and ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncologists, say instead of 74, let's look at a woman's potential longevity. I mean, right. Doctors don't play God, but potential longevity, and continue mammograms as long as we can theorize, or based on their health, that they're going to live another 10 years. You know, I think we have to do that. We can't just say to older women, you don't matter, because a misconception is that older women will have, slow-growing tumors. 20% of women who are in their 70s, 80s, or 90s will have aggressive cancers. And if only we can find them early, we can save them an impact on their quality of life and their dignity by having them diagnosed with delayed breast cancers because they didn't have mammograms.
Well, let's move on, because I want to get to the topic of dense breasts. Okay, this keeps coming up, and something a little bit more about the technology of trying to find cancer. Is a routine mammogram sufficient in evaluating breast cancer in a woman with the so-called dense breasts?
Absolutely not. So we have strong data, and I just have to look, and I'm actually looking at the task force statement that said there, quote, was not enough evidence to assess the risk of women with dense breasts. There's been data that's well respected. For example, Gene Weigert, who's a radiologist in Connecticut, presented at the San Antonio Breast Conference. Now, this is a conference every December where it's an international conference. And let me tell you, they don't allow you to present data. That was 10 years ago. She presented concrete data that a significant number of women with breast cancer who have dense breast tissue, the cancers will be missed unless you do a screening ultrasound. And you and I are proud to be in Connecticut. We have a strong Connecticut General Assembly. And in 2009, they passed legislation that said that insurance should cover screening ultrasounds if a woman has dense breasts. Now, there's another role for MRI, but also I want to stay on ultrasound right now. So the U.S. Preventive Task Force says there's not enough data. There's been data around a long time, so much so that the FDA in September of 24 will be releasing recommendations that women with dense breast tissue should have further imaging with screening ultrasound. So now you're the average woman and you receive this letter, so radiographers will have to give a printed report to the patient. You have dense breast, you should have further studies. And now patients, unless you're in one of the 38 states that has legislation, are going to say, well, will my insurance cover this? Or what does this mean? And you and I know when people are confused, they withdraw. They stop doing mammograms. They stop doing self-exam because there's mistrust in the healthcare system. So these recommendations only create more mistrust.
And if you need to get an advanced study, at least in the state of Connecticut, you do not have to pay any out-of-pocket costs, correct? There's no co-pays.
That's absolutely right. So Connecticut took the lead in 2009 because of a woman named Nancy Baccaro, who sadly had dense breasts and is no longer with us, and a woman named Jan Kritzman, who was instrumental in Connecticut Public Act 22-90 that says a woman, not only does insurance have to pay for the screening ultrasound, but she need not pay a deductible or a copay. Not just for ultrasounds, but MRIs and for diagnostic mammograms or biopsies.
Well, I want to thank you. First of all, I want to congratulate you on retirement. And hopefully you will enjoy your retirement. But I have your number, okay? And I will continue to call on you because of your fierce advocacy for women. Thank you very much. And please enjoy a very healthy and full retirement.
Thank you for this opportunity to do what you do so well, educating your audience.
Thank you, Kristen. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Lenore Williams, and we're going to be chatting about mortality, maternal mortality here in Connecticut and throughout the United States. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And my next guest is Dr. Lenore Williams, in continuing with our theme of Mother's Day Eve and women's health. I wanted to get Dr. Williams on. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut and spent 25 years in private practice in Eastern Connecticut. And the reason I want to get her on is this: the question of maternal health has been such a big deal, and maternal death rates. It just shocked me that we are among the very few countries where the maternal mortality rate is increasing. And I need to know why, and as I'm sure most of our listeners do. Lenore, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Lissy. Thank you so much for inviting me to discuss this very timely topic. And happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there and others who provide nurturing care for growing children.
Let's get right into it. Well, first of all, some of your background. You've been in private practice before coming into academics. Am I correct?
That's correct. So I did my residency and my medical school at UConn, and then practice in a small community hospital in Eastern Connecticut, and did that for about 27 years before returning to UConn.
So can you talk to us a little bit about what is the maternal death rate? How is that calculated? What are we talking about?
So, you know, I think it's important to get our definitions straight. So when we talk about maternal mortality, we're talking about the death of a person while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of a pregnancy. And you would eliminate things like auto accident or a train wreck. You know, that would not be included in that statistic. And this rate is calculated by the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. And to just give you an idea of where we stand, I was looking at data from 2021 here in the U.S. We are at 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, and that number has gone up since 2019.
So what's driving that number? I've looked at these statistics. I mean, when we get down to basic numbers, in 2020, the number was 861 deaths for the year. Okay, not just over 100,000. But in 2021, it jumped to 1,205 deaths in 2021. Is it purely because of COVID? I mean, what is the driver behind this increase in maternal death?
It's important to recognize and acknowledge that, at least according to the CDC, over 80% of maternal deaths in the United States are preventable. And to your point, in order to prevent these deaths, we need to have a better understanding of why they are occurring. And pregnancy itself is a very complex state, both physically and mentally. And therefore, complications and maternal mortality tend to be very complex, multifactorial, and numerous, and can be determined by certain communities, certain states. They may differ from time to time. But among the leading causes, there are things like cardiac and coronary disease, hemorrhage, blood loss, hypertensive or high blood pressure disorders, sepsis, severe infection, and mental health disorders. And I think all of these things sort of lie at the feet of our inadequate systemic healthcare system.
First of all, I'm shocked right now because I was shocked at the original number, but the fact that 80% of these are avoidable is, I don't even have a word for it, really. Let's talk about that, because when we look at this, and let's call it what it is, women of color are more susceptible to dying in childbirth. And people think childbirth, right? Everybody loves the analogy. Well, women in China or in Asia, right? They would have a baby and then go back and work in the field. I hate that analogy because it is such a complex issue. But why is it? First of all, let's get right to why are women of color predominantly losing their lives in childbirth?
Yeah, so women of color, Black women in particular, being pregnant is life-threatening. The number for U.S. mortality was 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births. For Black women, that number is 69.9 deaths for 100,000 live births, and that's 2.6 times the rate for white women. Black women who die as a consequence of pregnancy-related issues typically have significant there's cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, cardiomyopathies, which are the leading causes for those deaths. And given the fact that there doesn't appear to be a difference when you account for socioeconomic differences, that Black woman with a PhD degree is three times more likely to die as a consequence of being pregnant than a white woman who has a high school degree or less.
And so why is that? Because typically people who have an education, right, are better informed and should have better access, right, to care. Is it an access question? Because when I look at the states now with the highest maternal mortality rates, I'm looking at Georgia, Louisiana, Indiana, Alabama, Arkansas. Is it an access question?
So, but certainly for women of means, it is not an access question. You know, unfortunately, we have to stare the problem straight in the face. And some of this has to do with the need to evaluate these problems using a health equity lens and a racial lens. For centuries, Black people, Black women in America have sustained all sorts of atrocities. And that certainly takes a toll. And it's the weathering effect, the shortening of telomeres. All of those things, I believe, play a role. In addition to many Black women feel that often during their healthcare encounters that they're not heard, or their concerns are not taken seriously and are dismissed. And I think some of this has to do with implicit bias that is found in some of the healthcare providers.
When we look at, let's look at your field, obstetrics and gynecology. Are young physicians going into OBGYN these days? Because I can't imagine that, to be honest with you. As much as when I was a medical student, it was such a rewarding field. But with the legal climate, the government climate, things like that, are fewer people going into OBGYN?
According to the last match numbers, I don't believe that is necessarily true, but again, people were making their decisions prior to the reversal of Roe versus Wade. And certainly there is an exodus of obstetrician gynecologists from many of those states who have restrictive practices regarding the full scope of women's reproductive health, and I'm speaking of abortion. Time will tell if fewer medical students are considering obstetrics and gynecology, and if the current climate of this severely draconian restrictive measures regarding comprehensive women's reproductive health care continue to exist. I did want to make one other point. When we're talking about about pregnancy, and often people consider, okay, I delivered my baby, baby's good, I'm good, all is great. It's important to emphasize that 53% of pregnancy-related deaths occur from 7 days after to 1 year postpartum. And the reason that is so significant is that often postpartum care ends at 6 or 8 weeks after the delivery, yet we have some of these catastrophic, deadly things occurring out through a year. Many women do not have insurance coverage that will cover that entire year, and as a consequence, they're not getting care.
So, let's look at it. I mean, we looked at the states where they're having higher incidence of maternal mortality and maternal death. But when we look at the states with the lower numbers, I mean, we're looking at Connecticut, thank goodness, California, Pennsylvania. What are these states doing that these other states are not doing?
So, I think around 2006, 2007, California did something that was very progressive. They undertook measures to reduce their maternal mortality rate. And what they did was they started to develop this collaborative, which resulted in making up patient care, patient safety bundles, which are based on evidence-based practices of best care that could be implemented for common obstetrical issues, things like obstetrical hemorrhage, things like hypertension, things like substance disorder. And California was able to reduce their already low maternal mortality rate by, I think, by about half.
It's by far the lowest in the country.
You're answering the question for me.
Because I was looking at these numbers and saying, why is California at 10.1 and even Connecticut is at 16.7? So,
They made a commitment to reduce their maternal morbidity and mortality, and so many hospitals in our area have embraced their toolkits and their safety bundles to further help in reducing maternal morbidity and mortality. The other thing I think it's important to highlight here, and we're talking about things like those conditions that may be as a consequence of the medical aspects of pregnancy, but there are also those things that have to do with maybe perhaps the social aspects of pregnancy. Harvard School of Public Health came out with a study in October that indicated that women in the U.S. who are pregnant, who have recently given birth, are more likely to be murdered than die from obstetric causes. And these homicides are linked to a deadly mix of intimate partner violence and firearms. That knocked me off my chair when I saw that. Something like that, I'm not sure whether that would be actually listed in the maternal mortality indicators, but that I found to be astounding. And so we certainly have to continue to do appropriate screening for intimate partner violence, do it more thoroughly and more frequently.
Absolutely. These are astounding pieces of information. I wanted to touch on some of the other people that you work with, paraprofessionals, from the standpoint of, can you explain to our listeners the role of midwives, doulas, APRNs? It gets confusing for folks. I mean, they know what a doctor is and what an obstetrician is, but can you explain the role for doulas and midwives and how that impacts the statistics?
So these are folks who all provide valuable contributions to the healthcare team taking care of that pregnant patient and that newly delivered patient and postpartum patient. And depending upon healthcare facility and training, these folks will do different things. Typically, nurse practitioners will have more of a hands-on. They may see patients postpartum or during their office visits, during their prenatal care. Nurse midwives deliver patients as well as caring for them during their prenatal care and their postpartum care. Typically, they're caring for patients who are who do not have known complex medical issues. And then doulas and community health workers, doulas especially, have become more prevalent over the last 5 or 10 years. They provide support, non-medical support, to the mom and to the dad during labor, during postpartum, and they provide that care that it might often be provided by a close friend or a mother. Back in situations where when a woman was pregnant, it was a community event where the community, the village, embraced that woman and took care of her. That woman. And I think we need to start moving back toward that model where we involve more of the community, more doulas, more community healthcare workers. Some patients will feel that they get better care, more attentive care with nurse midwives. But all of these folks are important contributors to the care of our pregnant patients.
Lenore, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today and really everything you do for our community. It's a pleasure. It's one of the pleasures of working out in stores at our health center in stores is because we have so many different specialists under one roof. And we get to share patients and really learn from each other. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for everything you do, Lenore.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. You have a great day. Happy Mother's Day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. I want to take time to thank my guests today and everybody for putting this together. Dr. Kristen Sarvos for her time, as well as Dr. Lenore Williams. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board, but Matt Saroy really helped me put this all together. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next up on WTIC will be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
The preceding program was pre-recorded. This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.